Passover day, and it falls on the Sabbath. It's interesting that this only happens, I think it was 9 times during the 19th century that it actually, the Passover falls on the Sabbath. And I won't talk about that today. That's not my subject, but it's very interesting because on that particular day, the wave sheaf offering is altered just a little. I hope that I can at least point that out tomorrow. Nisan 14. Our minds are focused on the real Passover that was offered, the real sacrifice. Now, I don't mean that we still don't remember that the Israelites came out of Egypt on they were given permission on this particular day to leave Egypt, and they left in the night. I'm quite sure it was very shortly after midnight, because they were to stay in their houses till morning, and of course morning starts right after midnight. So when they got the word, they vamoosed and took off. I want to point out, however, that when Jesus made the supreme sacrifice, that was the most important part of this day. I want to turn to Mark, the 11th chapter, for a starter. Mark, the 11th chapter, and point out one thing here. You see, the book of Mark actually gives us the little keys that help us determine the days between Nisan the 8th and the 14th. Without Mark's account, we wouldn't know which day is which here, but with it, we have at least a clue to the accounting. In Mark, the 11th chapter, I want to start in verse 11. Maybe I better turn to it here myself. Mark 11 and verse 11, where it says, "And Jesus went into Jerusalem and into the temple." Now, I wanted to point this out because this probably, at least as far as we're able to discern, this was the 9th day of Nisan. Now, that year, you see, Nisan 15 was on Thursday. Passover day was on Wednesday. That is the fourth day of the week. So if this was Nisan 9, it was the preparation day for the weekly Sabbath. And I think it's good to realize that Mark gives us the clue for all of this. I'm not going to read all of those accounts to point that out to you here. That's not my subject. But when Jesus went into Jerusalem, he came into the temple. And when he had looked around at all things, as the hour was already late, see, it was late on the afternoon or late in the preparation day for the Sabbath, he went, this was the eighth day of Nisan. I got one day ahead of myself here. I want to get to verse 12 where it tells us the ninth day, because it says, this was the day, incidentally, that he rode into Jerusalem gloriously before the whole crowd, and you can read that in the fourth part of the chapter, and also in the ninth chapter of John, which gives us the starting of all of this. He rode into Bethany with the 12. Now the next day here, if that was the eighth day of Nisan, then this would be the ninth. That's what I'm really trying to point out here. When they came out from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if there would, if he could find something on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. Verse 14, in response, Jesus said to it, "Let no one eat fruit from you ever again." And his disciples heard it, They looked at the tree, and of course nothing happened right then, did it? As far as that goes, except the important thing that they heard. Nothing, no fruit from you ever again. They heard that, and his disciples heard it. And so they came to Jerusalem, and then Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple. They had sacrificial animals or fowl that they were using as merchandise right in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Then he taught, saying to them, "It is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves." Why did I want to point that out? Those leading people of among the Jews at that time, the leaders in the Jewish sect at that stage, what do you think they thought of all of that? When he goes in and upsets their money tables and scatters money all over the place, and he made them so furious that they could, you know, if you use a common expression, I guess they could bite nails. They just got so furious over that. Now, I happen to think that that was quite by godly design, because he made them so furious that nothing was going to stop them from killing him at this stage. This was just a couple of days before the Passover. And the scribes and Pharisees heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, verse 18 says, because all of the people were astonished at his teaching. Now, when evening had come, he went out of the city. He didn't stay there because at that stage he wasn't going to give them an opportunity to run him down at night. He didn't give them that opportunity yet. He did that only on the Passover night. It's kind of interesting that he did it that way. Now, I said the scribes and the Pharisees there were furious, that is, those leaders in the Jewish church. I might turn to Matthew 23 and point out that this was the religion of God. Matthew 23, and I brought the New American Standard Bible with me because I'm going to read that here out of the New King James first. It says, "Then Jesus spoke to the multitude and to the disciples, saying, the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." That's a pretty important seat when it comes to the what they called the law of Moses and what they called that covenant that Moses set. You know, they gave Moses all of the credit there for all of that sort of thing. "The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do." He told them to do it because they were administering the Mosaic law. And while they overdid it tremendously, they were doing it. "But do not do according to their words, but for they say and do not do." I wanted to read that, but I'm going to read that out of the New American Standard Bible. I brought a copy of that particularly for that reason. Matthew 23, I found this interesting when I looked this up in the Greek script. I found that, surprisingly, they could be even more right than the way it's translated in the King James. Listen, it says, then I'm reading verse 1 now, Matthew 23. "Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and the disciples, saying," verse 2, listen carefully, "the scribes and Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses." Kind of an interesting way to put it. Because they weren't doing it correctly, they were still administering the law, the covenant, the old covenant laws, and Jesus honored that. He said, go ahead and do that. And whatever they bid you do, you do that. But you see, as far as their position here was concerned, they put themselves in offices already. They were doing that. And history backs that up quite a bit. I just wanted to point that out because the Greek language is a very interesting one. You know, I pointed out before that whenever you deal with the Greek language there, as one of the men that I had the privilege of counseling for some time that was educated in Greece and knew the educational system there pretty well, said that there are 27 different tenses of verbs in the Greek language. They can do all kinds of things with those in the English because we only have about six in here, you know. And they can do all kinds of things with that. But the scribes and Pharisees were the leading people in the religion at that time. I wanted to point that out at the beginning here of all of this because Jesus made them so furious that they were ready to do anything in order to kill him, even violate their own established laws that they had, which they did, of course, on the Passover night. But now I want to go to Matthew 26, just another couple of pages over in my Bible. And verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished all of these sayings that he said to his disciples." Now when he had finished all these sayings, I want to emphasize that just a little. What were all of these sayings? You can read chapter 24, chapter 25, well, more than that, chapter 23, 24, and 25. Fantastic things he taught in those couple of days between the time that we read about when he entered the temple and the time that is designated here. You see, that was on the preparation day of the Sabbath, which was the ninth day of Nisan, as I pointed out, when he upset the money changers' table in the temple and did all of that and made them so furious. But he said it here in verse 2, Matthew 26 and verse 2, "You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." Now, he knew what was coming. That is almost unthinkable, as I pointed out last night in the Passover service. He was in agony. Now, there's no question about that because of facing what he was going to have to face here. Willingly, voluntarily, to pay the sacrifice for sin. Now, he knew that after 2 days is the Passover. You know, we had a big controversy over counting days when we counted Pentecost and kept it on Monday for all of those many years. I did that. And we realized that counting by the Jewish language is a little different than counting according to the English language, and we had to discern that. Now, there's a little controversy here about which day is which. I say that if he said after 2 days, it seems to me by the context of all of this that this must have been after the Sabbath, after the 10th day, which probably he continued teaching all of these things. You see, he finished these sayings. He said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days is the Passover and the Son of Man must be delivered up." Then the chief priests and the scribes and the elders and the people assembled at the place of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. Now, they plotted to do that. They were plotting this. Why? That's why he didn't stay in Jerusalem anymore. He wouldn't stay in Jerusalem. He went out of Jerusalem, lest they hunt him down and kill him before the time. But he knew that his time was coming to where he would be delivered up to be crucified. I think it's good for us to recognize that. They plotted to kill him, as verse 4 says. there was so much teaching that was covered in those couple of days. It's just amazing how much Jesus covered with his disciples at that time. The preparation day in the afternoon. Let's go to Mark, the 14th chapter. Mark, the 14th chapter. And I want to start in verse 12 on this one. Mark 14 and verse 12 says, "Now on the first day of unleavened bread," it's kind of interesting that it states it that way, on the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover. Now, when they killed the Passover, customarily, that has always been down through the ages on the 14th day of Nisan. I don't think there's any controversy by anybody on that day. This wasn't that day, however, because what happened that evening? I say it wasn't that day. I don't mean it couldn't possibly have been that day, and I'm not going to put it that way either. But it seems to me that the sense of all of this would be that he told them the afternoon before that meal in the evening that they had to kill the lamb and do the preparing for the meal and all of this, so forth and so forth. That seems to make sense to me anyway, so that it would be. He sent, verse 13 says, he sent out two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the city, and a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him. And wherever he goes in, and say to the master of the house, the teacher says, where's the guest room that I may eat the Passover with my disciples? Then he will show you a large upper room, furnished, and prepared. There, make ready for us." Now, I don't know who this was. Jesus did, obviously. And it must have been quite a well-to-do person that had the property here and the place where they met. But that's not here nor there. It doesn't tell me very specifically what that was. But verse 16 says, "So his disciples went, came to the city, and found it just as he had said to them. And they prepared the Passover." Now, they did what he had told them. Probably this was on the 13th day of Nisan. And I said I can't confirm that absolutely and positively, but it seems the sense of it would be there. Now, the Jews, to this day, I had the privilege of working in New Jersey for about 5 years, and 7% of the state of New Jersey is Jewish, and they always say that there's more Jews in New York City than there are in the whole of Jerusalem, I mean in Israel itself, and so there are a lot of Jews up there in that territory. Fine people. We had some in the church, and I have already told you about incidents about some of that, but they keep the Seder meal on the evening of the 15th, that is, after the 14th, at the beginning of the 15th day. And they do that to this day. I had the privilege of, seeing that and experiencing the fact that they were doing that up there at that time. They keep the Seder meal on the 15th. Now, Jesus kept the Passover meal on the evening of the 14th, so that's clear. We don't worry about the timing of that, because he was crucified that same day, later in the day. And, I hope before I'm finished, I'll tell you why I'm not worried about the controversy of these issues of the exact timing of all of this anyway. But that's neither here nor there. I want to go to Hebrews, the 10th chapter now, because I want to talk about the real Passover sacrifice. That's important. I wanted to lead up to that because Hebrews, the 10th chapter, It isn't that you haven't heard any of this before. You have, of course. That's why we have these times, is a reminder of the things that we need to have brought back to our memories all of these times. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 1. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come. Now, what law was he talking about? Obviously, the old covenant law that they kept. And the old covenant law was what they called the Mosaic law. Actually, it's God's law, God covenant with Israel. But it was a shadow of things. Well, a shadow is a shadow of something that's real, you know. If something goes by that is real and casts a shadow, the shadow is a shadow of the real thing. And it's a shadow of the good things to come and not the very image of the things. The image went by and there was a shadow cast, and that's what the Old Covenant represented relative to the awesomeness of the sacrifice that was paid for a wretch like me. Excuse me, but I'm touched pretty deeply by that every time I think about that. But and not the very image of the things can never, with these same sacrifices, the sacrifices that were done day in and day out throughout Israel, if they would actually keep the law of Moses, which they offered continually, year by year, make those who approach perfect? No. That would never be. Those sacrifices were a shadow, not the real thing at all. But they always pointed to it. Now, verse 2. For then would they have not ceased to be offered? No, they would have kept right on offering them if they were of real value after the sacrifice was really paid. For the worshipers once purged. That's an interesting word. My margin, I think, has cleansed there, if I remember correctly on that. I guess I could look it up. Yes, cleansed for that word purified. Purged. Purified here would have had no conscience of sin. I think your King James does say purged, if I'm not mistaken. I may be wrong on that too, but when you purify something that has, well, just like I was for 30 years already steeped into the ways of this world and all that I had to go through during that period of time, I don't like to say it that way. All that I caused myself to have to go through, maybe it would be a little better way of explaining it. Because I did a lot of things that I brought on myself, you see. Now, but all of that had to be purged out or cleaned out, cleared out. It always reminds me of the days in my family. I was reared in a German family. And Germans never without their beer and wine, you know, they've got to have that wherever they go. And the whole community where I lived in always made beer and wine. That was just as customary to me when I grew up as when I was born. I never knew a time when I was small we didn't have a barrel of wine in the cellar. Now, that was just customary in German. That's the way it was, see. Now, we have no wine barrel. And when we'd empty that wine barrel, why, sometimes we'd just roll it out there in the yard. Now, usually we'd want to keep it so that it was damp, so it wouldn't fall to pieces, you know, dry up. But when you want to clean that up, how do you do it? It's only got a bung hole, you know, a small bung that you fill it with and so forth. How do you clean that all out? Well, you don't get down in there with your hands and wash it, that's for sure. So you purge it. You start flowing water, clean water through that thing. Let it flow, let it flow, let it flow, let it flow until it washes all of that old crud out of there. Now, crud is not really bad as far as a barrel of wine is concerned. It was dregs from the grapes, and maybe a little mold, which, of course, is what penicillin is anyway, so that wasn't that bad. But had to wash it all out so it would be clean. Well, when you purge it, that's kind of like purging the sin out of us, if you really stop to think about it. It doesn't all come out easy. We've got to wash it and wash it and wash it and wash it a long time to get all of that out. That's just the way it is. That's the process we have to go through for all of the rest of our lives in the process of being fully converted. Now, we'll never make it in this life because of Satan the devil, because those tempts will always be there, but we have to recognize the process and go through it, the process of purging, purifying, getting cleansed, which have no more conscience of sin. I didn't read the rest of verse 2, but verse 3 says, "But if this sacrifice, by this sacrifice, there is a reminder of sins every year." That's what it was, a shadow. Showed what they looked like. But it was a reminder of sin every year. "For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. Therefore, when he came into the world," he said, what was quoted from the Old Testament, "sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me." God had a body prepared so that that body could pay the one sacrifice that would clear the law for all of mankind. Took the Creator to do that, but otherwise it wouldn't even be legal. Think about it. The Creator that created all things, and without Him was not anything created that was created, was the one that actually paid the sacrifice to make it legal, to eliminate the penalty of God's law. I think it's important that we recognize that. "A body you have prepared for me, in burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you had no pleasure." God didn't have any pleasure in all of that, but it was a reminder to them. "Then I said, behold, I have come, in the volume of the book it is written of me, to do your will, O God." Now, I think that's very vitally important that we grasp the awesomeness of that, the blood sacrifice that was paid there, the blood offering that was shed to fulfill the penalty of God's law, which said the wages of sin is death. Ever sinned? All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And so we have the death penalty hanging over us, and all are going to die. There's no doubt about that. It's 100% statistic, but that's not the life that that sacrifice paved the way for. That sacrifice is a much greater sacrifice. See, a body was prepared so that he could die, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, without sin, could submit himself to pay the penalty for all the sins of mankind. So, mind-boggling that we can't grasp it. We can believe it because he said so. But to see the magnitude of it is way beyond the human mind, I'm sure. I think we all ought to realize that. You know, he was cut off in the middle of the week. We said Passover was on Wednesday. I'm going to turn to just one verse. I've done it before. Daniel, the 9th chapter and verse 27. I just want to turn to that. Daniel chapter 9 and verse 27. And I won't dwell on this. I've preached about it before, and you know I have. Daniel 9, verse 27 says, "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week." Now, that was Jesus coming to this earth to preach his message. And he came to confirm a covenant for 1 week. Now, I pointed out before that 1 week is seven days, and if a day for a year would be 7 years. And Christ's ministry lasted for 3.5 years. And so that it says there, reading on, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. That's what we're talking about over here in Hebrews 10. He brought an end to them, to the sacrifice and offerings. And on the wings of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even with the consummation which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Now, he made an end to the sacrifices, all right. I said I just wanted to point out that one verse because back in Hebrews, the 10th chapter, where we left off, I want to pick it up in verse 8 where it says, previously saying, sacrifice and offering, burnt offerings and offerings for sin you did not desire, nor had pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law, to the covenant that was made with Israel. God was the husband, Jesus Christ was the husband of that covenant with Israel. No one has ever seen the Father at any time or heard his voice. Jesus was clear on that. Then Jesus was the God of the Old Covenant, that was the God of the Old Testament that made the covenant with Israel, brought there at Mount Sinai. And that was pictured as a marriage covenant, which it was, and legally bound. He was bound to them until death do part. Well, when he was crucified, the husband died. That was the end of that covenant. That was the end of the so-called Mosaic laws. Now, were they ever wrong? God never made a law for anybody that was wrong. I know people turn to Colossians. Maybe I ought to turn to that because maybe some of you are aware of that. Colossians 2 and verse 14. I studied diligently with the Jehovah's Witnesses for just a little while, and I got to know this verse because they pointed it out to me so seriously, and I'd never looked at it for what it literally said myself. I wouldn't do that then. Colossians 2 and verse 14 says, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. So those old commandments and all of the old laws and all of that was nailed to the cross, and that was what they taught. I didn't swallow that. And I wouldn't swallow that. I wouldn't take that. Because you know what that literally says? I didn't read that the way I should have read it then. Read it again. Having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that were what? That was against us? When did God ever give a law that was against anybody? God never gave a law against anybody. If they would have kept it, they'd have been blessed all the way. It wasn't against anybody, and which was contrary to us, it says. God never gave a law that was contrary to anybody. I just thought I'd point that out because I know the teachings are there, and the Jehovah's Witnesses are not the only ones that teach that. And it isn't that I'm here to run down religions. That's not the point. I want to tell you what the book says, though. And you want to see what it literally says. Where did I stop? I'll read verse 8 again. Previously saying, sacrifice and burnt offerings and offerings of sin you did not desire, had no pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law. Now, the Mosaic law was finished. If I made a contract with you to do
And it's a job. I don't care. Mow my lawn. Take care of my yard or whatever it may be. And I make a contract with you, and we write down the rules for the contract, what needs to be done, and you agree to it, and we sign the contract, signed and sealed. Then you come and do the job, just as it says in the contract, finish it, and I pay you for that. What happens to the law, the contract? Done. Finished. Over. Was it wrong? It didn't have to be wrong. And the covenant was finished. When Jesus fulfilled the covenant, that finished it. It wasn't wrong. Didn't have to have anything wrong about it. The only thing that was wrong about it is that the Israelites didn't keep it. It was a fault with them. That's what it says in the 8th chapter here of Hebrews, and I won't turn to that, but you see, the law was wrong. Verse 9 says, "Behold, I have come to do your will, O God." He takes away the first, that's that old covenant made with Israel, that he may establish the second. Now, that was established on the day of Pentecost, wasn't it? See, the Holy Spirit came upon the disciples out there, 120 of them, and dumbfounded everybody because it stood as tongues of fire on them. By that will we have been sanctified, that is, set apart, through the offering of the holy over the body of Jesus Christ. He said, "A body you have prepared for me, once for all." Now, verse 11, "And every high priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins." The only way that penalty could be paid was for the Creator Himself to be made into a body, if you please, that would die. And He came and died. And that satisfied the law of God. So that all those blood sacrifices had no more meaning at all. Every high priest, verse 11, stands daily in offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But this man, verse 12, after he had offered one sacrifice for sin forever, sat down at the right hand of God. Now, it doesn't mean that once he paid that sacrifice that nobody was ever able to sin again. You know that, and I know that. We still have to purge the sin out of our lives, and it's a process we have to go through. That's verse 13. "From that time waiting till his enemies are made his footstool." Now, sin will be done away with eventually, but it isn't there yet. New potential gods are being born all the time. Society by society, by step down, generation by generation. "For by one offering, he has," verse 14, "he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified." That is the end then of the need for any other blood sacrifices. No need for that part. The sins can be taken away. Our sins can be taken away from us as a result of the sacrifice that he paid. And it's the only possible way. Now, it's interesting that God isn't going to deal forever with our sins. But he's going to give everybody an opportunity at some time or other to have their sins forgiven and turn to God's way to keep God's laws completely and entirely. I want to go to Psalm 103 just for a couple of verses. Psalm 103. Those sins will be
removed eventually, completely, and entirely. Psalm 103 and verse 11. I'll pick it up in verse 11. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward those who fear him. God wants a family, and in his mercy he designed a program or a plan whereby he will have his family. And we have an opportunity to become a part of that as one of his very children. But then, so great is his mercy toward those that fear him. In verse 12, as far as east is from the west. How far is that? You can't measure that. You can point out there all you want to, you know, east and west. I'm pointing, you know, east and west. You can point as far as you want to, but that, isn't it, it's just endless. That's God's mercy. He's willing to put up with us. As far as the east is from the west, so far as he removed our transgressions from us. They're going to be gone. Ultimately, gone. Completely and entirely. Now, they're not gone right away. As a father pities his children, and so the children have to grow up and learn, don't they? As a father pities his children, so the Eternal pities those who fear him. And he knows our frame and remembers that we're dust. He knows that. He realizes that we're weak and have our problems, and of course we do. I want to go to Micah, the little book of Micah. Jonah, I talked about Jonah a couple of Sabbaths ago. Micah comes right after it. Micah chapter 7, I just want to turn to this because it's so interesting to read the earlier part of this chapter. I'm not going to go through all of that. I probably could back up through some of it to see that is talking about the end time when all of these things are going to be fulfilled. But I want to drop right on down to verse 16. The nations shall see and be ashamed of all of their might. We have technology today. It's probably unthinkable in any other society in which mankind ever lived. I don't know that for sure. I don't know how advanced they were in the days of Noah, because Jesus said it'd be the time when he comes will be like it was in the days of Noah. So maybe they were more advanced than we are, but I don't know this. We are so advanced in society, in science today, that as Mr. Armstrong always pointed out, and I always had to laugh at that, because you see, I was educated as an engineer myself, and Mr. Armstrong always said, scientists say, just give us enough time, we'll solve a problem, any problem, doesn't make any difference what it is, we'll solve them all. Okay, God says, take your time, go ahead, have whatever time you want. Go ahead and solve them. They'll never solve them, will they? They just dig deeper into the pit. That's all they do. No, we develop marvelous things, and then corruption hits. We have people that use them in the wrong ways, and it happens repeatedly, over and over and over and over again. I don't need to describe that. You know you're living in it, and it's that way. So, let's see. I read verse 16. The nations shall see and be ashamed of all their might. God says, if you want to solve it, go ahead. I'll give you all the time you want. What they're going to do is kill themselves. And if God didn't intervene, they'd annihilate everybody. But before they quite get everybody, it's kind of interesting. God will probably save a tithe. But he'll stop it. All nations shall see and be ashamed of all their might. They shall put their hand over their mouth, and their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like the serpent. I was reading that to
some prospective member one time, and they say, "Oh, you know, lick the dust like a serpent. They don't eat dust. What are you talking about?" No, they do too. As a boy, I'm sorry to, I don't want to get gory about it, but I've chopped them open and seen dust right in their innards. They eat it. They do, literally. I don't know if you realize that, but they do eat the dust. They'll lick the dust like a serpent. They shall crawl from their holes like snakes of the earth. They shall be afraid of the Eternal, our God. They shall fear because of you. They won't be making fun of God. You can't go out and criticize any newscaster that I know of at all in any way today without him coming right back and saying, "Get your head out of that book. It doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, it's just a bunch of old stories." That's about the stuff you see. I see that reported time and time again, right in newspapers and items published. They're going to be afraid, and they shall fear because of you. Who is a God like you with all of that mercy that he has and the greatness that he has? Pardoning iniquity, verse 18, and passing over the transgression of the remnant of his heritage. Passing over them once they can be paid for and the person repents and comes to obedience of the laws of God, which they should have been doing all the time and enjoying the benefit of it. I had a hard time coming to that realization myself. It would have been so much better if I just obeyed God's laws in the first place. He does not retain his anger forever. Finishing verse 18. He does not retain his... He's not going to go on forever. No. It's going to be cleaned up, and then there will be a glorious time like is way beyond the imagination of the human mind. I've quoted that verse so many times, 1 Corinthians 2:9, where eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man, the things that God has prepared. It will be so delightful because he delights in mercy. He will... He will again have compassion on us and will subdue our iniquities. He will cast all of our sins into the depths of the sea. Now, say you're down deep enough, why, we're never going to go down there. We ain't got any anymore, that's for sure. In the depths of the sea. You will give truth to Jacob and mercy to Abraham, which you have sworn to our fathers from days of old. Marvelous picture when we really see it. The beauty of what God has planned for us is so magnificent as a result of that one sacrifice that was paid on this very day. You see, he died at about the ninth hour, which was about 3 p.m., about the time we started service. We commemorate that. I don't mean it was exactly the same time in Jerusalem and all of that. I'm not trying to compare that. I'm just saying it was at that time of the day. And he died at that time. And we do need to remember that sacrifice and realize the awesome greatness of it. I want to turn to Jeremiah, the 23rd chapter. And I said I would tell you why I don't worry about all of these little technicalities that people have back in when Israel went out of Egypt, and they have come up with all kinds of technicalities, and even the Council of Elders is not sure about the timing of all of that. And I know whenever they published the paper on that, they purposely left out four of the major scriptures on that, but that's neither here nor there either. I don't care about that because it makes no difference. Here's the reason why. Jeremiah 23, verse 7. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord. Now, they haven't reached it yet because we still talk about the children of Israel crossing the Red Sea and all of this. But the days are coming, says the Lord, that they will no longer say, as the Lord lives, who brought up the children of Israel from the land of Egypt, but as the Eternal lives, who brought up and led the descendants of the house of Israel
from the North Country and from all the countries where I've driven them. He doesn't drive anybody there as far as literally as doing that, but he allows them to go. He allows the circumstances so they go there. And they shall dwell in their own land. Finally, forget all about Egypt then. They won't have to even remember that anymore. That's why those little technicalities don't really bother me that much. If I don't understand exactly what all those technicalities are, it doesn't bother me at all. Because all that's going to be forgotten anyway. In the reality of the true reality of the fulfillment of all of these things. Which I think is so absolutely awesome that our minds do need to be focused on them. I hope that all of you have an excellent night to be remembered and enjoy it. And you'll have to put up with me again tomorrow afternoon. Two services will be at 2:30 tomorrow afternoon.